Part of giving an introduction to Ezekiel, I'd like for us to read the first three verses of chapter 1. Ezekiel, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Now, you may have noticed that verse 1 is written in the first person, in an autobiographical way. He says, I was among the captives, I saw this. But verses 2 and 3 are written in the third person. Ezekiel is spoken of as though he's somebody other than the writer. I'd like to say that verses 2 and 3 are the only verses in the whole book that are not written in the first person. The whole book is written in first person as though it is written by the man who had the experiences in the book, and that man was Ezekiel the prophet, except for those two verses. And those two verses probably were put in there by a scribe who either copied out Ezekiel in the early days or edited his work in some form, and he added his own comments so that we understand exactly who this Ezekiel was. You could see that if verses 2 and 3 were omitted, that verse 4 would flow quite naturally from verse 1, because verse 4 and following is autobiographical also. I looked and I saw. So without verses 2 and 3, we would have a smooth flow, but we would be lacking in some important information about who Ezekiel was, who this was that had the visions, what it was all about. In verse 1, it says it was in the 30th year, but it doesn't say of what. We're left to guess as far as how this 30th year is to be reckoned. Now, in verse 2, it says it was the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity. Now, the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity was, at the same time, the 30th year of something. And there is no reasonable explanation that has ever been suggested for what the 30th year was of, except it be the prophet's own lifetime. That is, it was his 30th year of life. He was 30 years old at the time. And that tends to be the general consensus of those who have studied in detail the book of Ezekiel. It is the only date in the book that it is not associated with any known event, and therefore it must be a reference to his own age at the time that he entered the ministry and had these visions. He was 30 years old. We find from verse 3 that the man's name was Ezekiel, and that his father's name was Buzi, and we find that he was a priest in verse 3. That means that, of course, he was of the lineage of Aaron in the tribe of Levi. And as a priest, at age 30, he would begin his priestly functions in Jerusalem, in the temple. That was the age that a young priest would begin to occupy the priestly office. He was born into the priestly family. He was now the age when he would ordinarily begin the priestly office in Jerusalem. The only problem was he was not in Jerusalem. He was in Babylonia. He was by the river Kebar, which was a major canal of the river Euphrates that connected it with the river Tigris, and it was used for commerce and such. It was a major canal. It was like a river, and it was somewhere probably southwest of the city of Babylon that he was, but he was one of the captives in Babylon, about 1,000 miles from home, about 1,000 miles from Jerusalem. Now, the time is associated with Jehoiakim's captivity. There were three deportations into Babylon of the Jews. And you remember that the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah had specifically prophesied that the Jews would go into captivity, that there would be a captivity in Babylon, in fact. And Jeremiah had stated that that captivity would be 70 years in duration. Well, that captivity came about through three different deportations. I've put them on the board here so that you can see when they were. The first deportation was in 605 B.C. This was when Nebuchadnezzar, who was not yet the king of Babylon, but was the general of the Babylonian armies at that time, his father being the king, Nebuchadnezzar came against Jerusalem. He took many of its chief citizens away, captive into Babylon. Among those citizens were Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom we have not studied yet. We'll study the book of Daniel after we study the book of Ezekiel. But the book of Daniel, of course, is another book that was written by a prophet who was in captivity in Babylon, as Ezekiel was. Daniel was taken into captivity in the first deportation when Nebuchadnezzar first came and took the most noble citizens. Daniel apparently was of royal birth, or of noble birth at least, and was taken into Babylon at that time in 605 B.C. Then 8 years later, there was another time that Nebuchadnezzar came against Jerusalem, and that was in the year 597. And at that time, there was a more general deportation. 10,000 Jews were deported, and King Jehoiakim himself, the king of Jerusalem, was taken also, and that's when Ezekiel was taken. So Ezekiel was taken in captivity 8 years after Daniel was. Though he may have been about the same age as Daniel, or even older than Daniel, because Daniel was a boy at the time that he went into captivity 8 years earlier. At any rate, Ezekiel's captivity, when he went into Babylonia, was along with 10,000 others and the king himself of Jerusalem, who was taken into captivity in 597 B.C. The record of this event is found in 2 Kings, chapter 24, and verses 11 through 18. 2 Kings 24, 11 through 18 describes this coming of Nebuchadnezzar and taking away Jehoiakim and 10,000 others. Though 2 Kings doesn't say so, Ezekiel was one of those that was taken in that captivity. Then, some 11 years later, Nebuchadnezzar came back and burned Jerusalem. Now, what happened in those 11 years in between, I'll share with you. When Jehoiakim was taken into captivity in 597 B.C., and Ezekiel and 10,000 others with him taken into Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar set up Jehoiakim's uncle, Zedekiah, to be the king in Jerusalem in his place. And later, Zedekiah rebelled. He sought aid from Egypt to rebel against Babylon. And that is why in 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar came back and damaged, destroyed Jerusalem because of the rebellion of Zedekiah. At that point, almost everyone was deported from Jerusalem. The city was destroyed, and most of the others were deported. And then Nebuchadnezzar set up Gedaliah to be a governor over a few that were left in Jerusalem. And Gedaliah, you might remember, was assassinated by his fellow Jews, after which those Jews and all that were left in Jerusalem fled to Egypt. They took Jeremiah forcibly with them to Egypt because they knew that retaliation from Babylon would come. And so there were three stages to the deportation. The first, which took the most noble citizens, including Daniel, in 605 B.C. Then the second, which took the king Jehoiakim and the 10,000 others, including Ezekiel, in 597. And then, 11 years later, the destruction of Jerusalem. And the reason I stress this is because this helps us to understand the time frame of Ezekiel's prophecy. Ezekiel was apparently 25 years old when he was taken into captivity. We understand this from the fact that he was 30 years old in the fifth year of that captivity. That's what we get in verses 1 and 2. In verse 2, it tells us it was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, and it was the 30th year of Ezekiel's life, which means that when the captivity took place, when he was taken into exile, he was 25 years old. So Ezekiel spent 5 years as a prisoner, as captive in Babylon, exile, I guess we'd say, rather than a captive. He spent 5 years before he was called to be a prophet. In the fifth year of that captivity, he was called to be a prophet. And then, of course, 6 years after that, Jerusalem was destroyed. Most of the book of Ezekiel, no, I shouldn't say most, half of the book of Ezekiel, the first 24 chapters, Are prophecies uttered by the prophet in those first 6 years of his ministry until the fall of Jerusalem? We'll talk about that a little later. Now, it's obvious that because of the time in which Ezekiel lived, he would have known Jeremiah. Jeremiah was prophesying in Jerusalem before Ezekiel was taken into exile and even beyond that point. So that Jeremiah would have been older than Ezekiel, but would have been familiar to him. If Ezekiel was 25 when he was taken into exile, he would have had many opportunities as an inhabitant of Jerusalem to have heard Jeremiah. And much of his message and even some of his language is like that of Jeremiah's. Perhaps he was strongly influenced by Jeremiah. Both of them prophesied the ultimate destruction of Jerusalem, and both of them spoke against false prophets who were giving the people a false security, telling people that Jerusalem was not going to fall. Jeremiah and Ezekiel both had the message that Jerusalem was in fact going to fall and that the captivity was going to be a lengthy one. He also lived, of course, contemporary with Daniel, though he probably never knew Daniel. They lived in different parts of the Babylonian Empire. Ezekiel apparently lived with the captives in Tel Abib, which was south and west of the city of Babylon, but in the Babylonian Empire. Daniel, on the other hand, lived right in Babylon. And you remember that Daniel, well, maybe you don't remember, I don't know if you've studied Daniel before, but Daniel was actually treated with royal honors and became actually something like the grand vizier or prime minister of Babylon. He became very powerful in Babylon. Ezekiel lived among the captives and never had any political power. So Daniel and Ezekiel lived at the same time in Babylonia in captivity, but Daniel lived in the palace, as it were. Ezekiel lived among the captives in one of the suburbs. And Ezekiel did know about Daniel, though they probably never met. Ezekiel mentions Daniel twice in his book, and he speaks of him highly. Daniel had a good reputation among the captives, and perhaps they hoped that his high position in Babylon would help them to be restored to their homeland someday. And in fact, that did happen. But in Ezekiel 14 and verse 14, it says, "Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord God." Now, I won't talk about what this verse is saying at this point, but notice that Noah, Daniel, and Job are mentioned, and that Daniel, who had been at this time 15 years in Babylon, had attained such a high status that he could be compared with the ancient righteous men who stood out in their generation like Noah and Job. I mean, it'd be really an amazing thing, because usually saints are not canonized until after their death. Usually men's greatness is not appreciated until after they're gone. The Jews would kill their prophets, and then a later generation would admire those prophets that their fathers had killed. But here we have two men who were from the ancient past, Job and Noah, and a contemporary living person, Daniel, set in the same ranks with them, which shows the high honor that was placed upon Daniel even during his lifetime by his fellow Jews, or at least by God, when that prophecy was uttered. There's a later mention of Daniel also. We'll consider those when we come to them. Ezekiel lived among the captives of Tel Abib, and from reading Ezekiel, we get a little bit of a picture of the kind of life that the Jews had in their captivity in Babylon. It was not anywhere near as rigorous or difficult as their captivity in Egypt had been for those 400 years before the Exodus. In Egypt, they were put to forced labor, hard labor with taskmasters that beat them and sought to kill their children and so forth. Whereas the Jews in Tel Abib, at least, and we might consider them a representative sampling of the Jews in captivity and exile, they had their own homes. They apparently had a certain amount of freedom because Ezekiel himself was able to wander about. He wandered out to the river Kibar and had visions, then he went back home again. And the elders of Israel would resort to Ezekiel's house to inquire of the Lord. They admired him, looked up to him as a prophet, and they came to his home to receive words from the Lord. Now this tells us also that in the Babylonian captivity, the Jews were allowed to have some kind of social structure that involved elders, that is, recognized leaders of their community. It would seem as though in the exile in Babylon, the Jews had a certain amount of liberty, though that was not good enough for them, of course. If you read Psalm 137, it's very clear that they were very galled by the captivity, and to be removed as they were from Zion was something that was very hard for them. And you can read, if you wish to, Psalm 137, to get the attitude of the Jews in their captivity. Psalm 137 was written by one of those Jews in the captivity. It says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof, for there they carried us away. They that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy, and so forth. So this is the way they felt. The captives in Babylon longed to be home in Jerusalem. However, the situation in Babylon was not anywhere near as bad as it had been for them in Egypt. And so the elders of the Jews in Tel Aviv would come to Ezekiel's house to inquire of the Lord. Now, even though they came to do that, it does not mean they were godly men. In fact, in most cases, Ezekiel had a nasty word for them, a very scathing word for them. God said to him, Why will these people inquire of me? They have set up idols in their hearts. And while the Jews had been sent into captivity, according to the prophets, for their idolatry, which they practiced at home in Jerusalem, they apparently did not practice idolatry in Babylon. The captivity cured them of that vice. But God points out to Ezekiel that though they were not overtly worshiping idols in Babylon, they were nonetheless still entertaining idols in their hearts. And so God, who sees the hearts, still had a hard word for them. In chapter 33, it's very clear, God makes it clear to Ezekiel, that even though the people were coming to him to hear the word of the Lord, they had no inclination at all to obey the word of the Lord. He says in Ezekiel 33, verses 30 through 33, also thou son of man, the children of thy people still are talking against thee by the walls and in the doors of the houses, and speak one to another, every one to his brother, saying, come, I pray you, and hear what is the word that cometh forth from the Lord. And they come unto thee as the people cometh, and they sit before thee as my people, and they hear thy words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goeth after their covetousness. And lo, thou art unto them as a very lovely song of one that hath a pleasant voice, and can play well on an instrument. For they hear thy words, but they do them not. And when this cometh to pass, lo, it will come, then shall they know that a prophet hath been among them. So he says, the people, they come and listen to you. They encourage you to, let's go hear the word of the Lord from Ezekiel. But God says, they're not going to do it. It's kind of entertaining to them. It's a break in the boredom. It's like listening to a man play a lovely song on an instrument, but it's just like going to a concert. You go there for entertainment. You don't go there because you want to be told what to do. You go there to serve yourself, not to learn how to deny yourself. And that's what the people were doing. They were coming to Ezekiel out of curiosity, out of a desire to know what God would say next, but not really out of a desire to do the will of God. So even though the elders came to Ezekiel's house to hear the word of the Lord, they did not obey the word of the Lord. Now, there were among the exiles in Babylon false prophets. Ezekiel speaks against them. Jeremiah spoke against them. Those false prophets were saying that Jerusalem would not be destroyed, and that those exiles who had already been taken to Babylon would soon be released to go back home again. That this whole ugly ordeal would soon be passed, and that God was still on their side, and that they should not settle in Babylon at all, but they should be always ready for God to release them to go back. You remember how Jeremiah, because you just finished studying that book, had written letters to those exiles. Remember, he was still in Jerusalem when these exiles were taken away. He stayed until the end there. He wrote to them telling them to go ahead and settle in, to cultivate the land and establish their homes and have children and so forth, because they're going to be there a long time. But the false prophets among the exiles were saying, no, Jerusalem is not going to be destroyed and will soon be restored. Well, that's, of course, the context of much of Ezekiel's prophecy. Chapters 1 through 24, the first half of the book, are uttered before Jerusalem fell, and they're almost all depicting the future overthrow of Jerusalem. His words were very opposite of those of the false prophets, because he was prophesying doom to the city where the others were not. And it was a 6-year period from the time that he began to prophesy to the time that Jerusalem fell. Ezekiel had a wife, and in the 9th year of his captivity, which would be when he was 34 years old, his wife died. This was not an accident or coincidence. This was an act of God, apparently. It coincided with the besieging of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar for the final siege that would lead to its destruction. And the death of Elijah's, did I say Elijah before? Ezekiel's wife, I didn't mean to say Elijah. The death of Ezekiel's wife was symbolic of the death of Jerusalem, God's wife. And Ezekiel was told not to mourn for his wife. And why he was told not to mourn for her is not entirely clear. And different people have different opinions. But it apparently has to do with the fact that God was not really going to mourn, or at least Jerusalem was not worthy to be mourned for the destruction that came upon her. At any rate, it's interesting that his wife comes into the picture. Many of the prophets, their marriages or their married status is affected by their call. You remember how Isaiah was married to a prophetess and she bore him some children that had symbolic names, and the birth of his children were signs, he said, to Israel. Jeremiah was told by God not to marry. Ezekiel, his wife died, and it was a sign. It was a prophetic sign. Hosea, we've already studied, had to marry a woman who would be unfaithful to him so that his married situation would reflect the relationship between God and his people. So many times the person's domestic condition, his marriage or lack thereof, was not just a coincidence, but something that God was using as part of his call. A prophet's call involved every part of his life. He wasn't just a guy who prepared a sermon on Sunday morning and go preach it and then could do whatever he wanted the rest of the time. The message he had was burning in him and was affecting every aspect of his life, including his marital status and the way he ate and the way he slept. As you can see from reading the opening chapters of Ezekiel was quite affected in every aspect of his life by his message. The prophecies of Ezekiel are dated, most of them, or many of them are, and they are always dated from the year that Jehoiakim went into captivity, which was apparently the year that he also went into captivity. And these prophecies span a time of at least 22 years from the time of his call. The last dated prophecy, the date of it is mentioned in chapter 29 and verse 17. And that date is the 27th year of the captivity. And that would mean it would be about 22 years after the call of the prophet. And if he was 30 years old when he was called, then he would be about 52 years old in the year that he gave his final dated prophecy. Now, he may have given some other prophecies after that, but we know that he had a ministry of at least 22 years, beginning when he was 30 years old and going on at least until he was 52 or older. Now, there's much about Ezekiel's ministry that's difficult to understand. My opinion is that Ezekiel is the most difficult book in the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, the most difficult book, I think, would be Revelation. And these two books have a lot in common. In fact, the book of Ezekiel is quoted a great deal in the New Testament, or alluded to. In the New Testament, the book of Ezekiel is quoted or alluded to 65 times. And 48 of those times are in the book of Revelation. There are 65 quotations or allusions to the book of Ezekiel in the New Testament. So you can see that the thought of Ezekiel is quite woven into the fabric of New Testament thought. But particularly in the book of Revelation, which contains 48 of these. And since the book of Revelation only has 22 chapters, you can see that there's on the average more than 2 allusions to Ezekiel per chapter in Revelation. And so, to understand Revelation, we would expect that an understanding of Ezekiel would be helpful as a prerequisite. There's many people eager to write books about Revelation. There are dozens or scores of books written in recent times about the book of Revelation. Very few of the authors who write on Revelation have any books out on Ezekiel. And it's very difficult, in fact, to find any good books out on Ezekiel, because it's a difficult book. And even the better scholars that I've tried to consult to gain more insights into the book seem to be at a loss to explain certain things in the book of Ezekiel. There's some just difficult things. It's hard to know what he's saying. in some cases. But we have to realize that much of Ezekiel's prophecies were acted out, and we are at a disadvantage because we can't see him acting them out. There are, in most cases, a description of what he did, but the description is not complete enough for us to fully understand, or we only have to guess about something. He's told to lie on one side for 390 days. Does that mean 24 hours a day for 390 days, or does that just mean when he slept at night, did he lie on that side instead of lying on in another position? Or does it mean that during certain hours of the day he went out in public and lay on one side where people could see him? After all, it was to depict something. But we're not told. All we're told is he lay on one side for 390 days and then on the other side for 40 days. But, as I say, if we had been there, we would have been able to see exactly how this was carried out. If this was just at night or all day long or a certain part of the day, the same is true about his special food that he had to eat. We don't know if that was the only food he ate or if he just ate this food publicly to depict something. It was symbolic. If you've read into the fourth chapter or fifth chapter of Ezekiel, you'll know already what I'm talking about there. But this is often the case. When Ezekiel is told to do something and act it out, we only have the sketchiest information given to us in print. His contemporaries would have the advantage of having actually seen him do it. And therefore, his prophecies would be more intelligible to them than they are to us. We are just left with some gaping holes in our knowledge of what he did and what his meaning was, therefore. There's at least one time that Ezekiel was transported, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell, God knoweth. But he was transported to Jerusalem from Tel Abib, from his home. The Lord picked him up by the hair, it says, and took him to Jerusalem. And in there he saw certain things, and he actually dug through the wall of the temple and things like that. Now, whether this all happened in a trance, in a vision, or whether he literally physically went there, is not entirely clear. But some of his prophecies, therefore, are uttered to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. It does not mean that the inhabitants of Jerusalem necessarily ever heard them. Because, of course, we know that many of the prophets prophesied to foreign nations, but probably never went there. That their prophecies were recorded, and when those foreign nations fell, it was seen that those prophecies were accurate. But those prophecies did not present actually a valid warning to those nations, because it's not likely that the prophets went to all those nations, to Ammon and Moab and to the Philistines and to Tyre and to Babylonia and to Assyria, and made all these prophecies. It's more likely that the prophecies are written largely for the sake of those who could hear them, which would be those in their own vicinity, and to show that when those prophecies came true, that God had known that these things were going to happen. When he prophesies against the inhabitants of Jerusalem, it does not necessarily mean that they are hearing him. He is in a vision or some other way transported to Jerusalem, and he sees things, abominations, that become God's case against Jerusalem and his rationale for destroying Jerusalem. But the prophecies that are uttered, it's not clear whether they were ever heard in the ears of the people of Jerusalem or not. There are four visions that Ezekiel had. You know, the book of Ezekiel has some aspects which make it one of the hardest books to read, and others that make it the most colorful. One of the colorful aspects is that his prophecies took so many different forms. He had four visions. There were four acted out prophecies, plus there were other kinds of prophecies he gave. The four visions were these. In chapter 1, he saw a vision of God's chariot and throne. That's what chapter 1 is about. That's his first vision. Then his second vision occupies chapters 8 through 11. This is where he's transported to Jerusalem, and he sees the abominations of Jerusalem, and in the end of this vision, he sees the Lord, the glory of the Lord, departing from the house of God. And so the second vision, which is chapters 8 through 11, is about the abominations of Jerusalem and the departure of the glory from the temple. The third vision is found in chapter 37. This is the best known, the most familiar of the visions that he had. That's the vision of the dry bones, which as he watched assembled into bodies and was a picture of the restoration of the captives to their homeland. That was chapter 37. And then the final vision is the last nine chapters, chapters 40 through 48. That is a vision of a temple I say a temple because no one's quite sure what temple it is. It's a very lengthy, very detailed description, at least as detailed as the description of the tabernacle in Exodus, and therefore as difficult to read through as was that passage, for the same reasons. Gives measurements and so forth. But no one is quite sure which temple it is that he saw. It does not appear to be the temple that Zerubbabel built after this time. It does not appear to be at any temple that has ever been built. Therefore, various theories have been advanced about what temple he saw. We'll talk about that when we get to those chapters. But those are his four visions. The vision in chapter 1 of the glory of the chariot of the throne of God. The second vision in chapters 8 through 11 of the abomination of Jerusalem and the departure of the glory from the house of God. The vision of the dry bones in chapter 37 and the vision of the temple, chapters 40 through 48. Now, that only makes up a portion of the prophecies of Ezekiel, but those are significant major visions. The way we are going to cover the book of Ezekiel will be topically. We're not going to go it verse by verse through the whole book, just chapter to chapter. There's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that it will get very tedious if we do that, and very repetitious. Ezekiel is repetitious in many respects. One thing is, within a given sentence, within a given verse, he can be extremely repetitious. You'll find that already in the passages in the first three chapters we'll come to. He'll say something, and it'll take him much longer to say it than you'd think it would need to take. He'll repeat certain phrases repeatedly in one sentence, which makes it very burdensome reading. It's almost like reading the Amplified Bible, only more inspired, perhaps. But it is tedious reading because of his repetitions since then. Then there are certain phrases that are repeated many, many times in the book. For instance, the expression, "They shall know that I am Jehovah," or "They shall know that I am the Lord." That expression occurs over 70 times in the book. There's also the repetition of the term "Son of Man" over 90 times in the book. Now, the key thought would seem to be that one I just mentioned, "They shall know that I am Jehovah," and that does come up a lot of times, and that would apparently be the main theme of the book. 29 times this statement is made in connection with the coming judgment on Jerusalem. As he is describing certain punishments coming upon the city of Jerusalem, he'll interject, "And then they shall know that I am Jehovah." 29 times. There are 24 times when that statement is made that he is discussing the judgment upon the heathen nations. When he's describing his judgment on the heathen nations, he interjects, "And they shall know that I am Jehovah," 24 times. And then in his prophecies that predict the restoration and blessing of the Israel of God, the expression occurs 17 times more, "And they shall know that I am Jehovah," which tells us some interesting things that God wants people to know about him. First of all, that he's a holy God who punishes sin among his people. 29 times he describes how he is going to punish his people for their sins, "And they shall know that he is Jehovah." In other words, they will know that he is a God. Jehovah is a God that does these kinds of things, who enforces his law and enforces righteousness among his people. Then those 24 times when it mentions this in the connection of his judging the nations, this stresses the fact that Jehovah is not just one of the territorial gods, as people generally thought of the gods in those days, but he is the universal God over the nations. He's got universal sovereignty. He judges other nations as well. All nations answer to him. And they shall know through this, through his judgment on the heathen nations, that he is Jehovah, and they'll know that Jehovah is sovereign over all the world, not only over the Jews. Then in those prophecies describing the restoration and blessing, "They will know that he is Jehovah" means that they will know that Jehovah is the God who is of great compassion and grace and mercy, because though he punishes, he yet restores. Though he is under no obligation to do so, yet he does. So the main concern God expresses throughout this book is that people would know that he is Jehovah and to know what kind of God Jehovah is. And that is made fairly clear, at least. But there are certain repetitions also of themes. especially in the first 24 chapters, the repetition of the themes about the destruction of Jerusalem and the siege and so forth, and it comes through different pictorial visions and descriptions and actions of the prophet. Now, let me just give you the overall outline of the book, and then we'll get into chapter 1. The first three chapters give us the opening vision and the call of Ezekiel to be a prophet. Just as most or many of the prophets do describe their call. Jeremiah does so in the first chapter of his book. Isaiah does in the sixth chapter of Isaiah. Here we have three chapters giving the circumstances of this man's call to the prophetic ministry. Chapters 1 through 3. Then chapters 4 through 24, all of which were uttered before the fall of Jerusalem, predict judgments upon Jerusalem, predict the fall of Jerusalem. Then chapters 25 through 36, or I'd say through 35, let me just check this here. Yeah, through 35. Ezekiel 25 through 35 are prophecies against the heathen nations. These come up after Jerusalem falls. Of course, there's no need for the prophet to predict the fall of Jerusalem anymore since it has now fallen. And now he turns his attention against the heathen nations that gloat over the fall of Jerusalem and prophesies their destruction also. In the midst of that section, there are two chapters that seem to be out of place, or one in particular, chapter 34, which is, chapter 33 actually is a chapter that just repeats parts of other places in the book. And then chapter 34 is a prophecy against the wicked shepherds of Israel and a prophecy about the coming good shepherd, Jesus. Those two are sort of sandwiched into the section that talks about the overthrow of the heathen nations. And then from chapter 36 to the end, chapters 36 through 48, we have prophecies about restoration of the nation, restoration of the temple, restoration of worship. So we have the first 24 chapters about the overthrow of Jerusalem, the next 10 chapters principally about the overthrow of heathen nations, and then the final chapters from 36 to 48, about 13 chapters, talk about the restoration of God's people. All right, let's get into chapter 1. We already read the first three verses, so we'll start at verse 4. He was at the river Kebar, somewhat a little ways away from his home. What he was doing there, we don't know. But it says, "And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof was the color of amber out of the midst of the fire." Now, this verse tells us what first called his attention to something out of the ordinary. Now, he had been 5 years in captivity at this time, and nothing out of the ordinary had happened. He did not consider himself to be a prophet during those 5 years. He was to be a priest if he would ever go back to Jerusalem. He would be a priest there, but he could not be a priest, of course, in Babylon, because there was no temple there to worship or to conduct the sacrifices in. So he was just another captive Jew for 5 years, but on this occasion he happened to be out probably meditating or praying over by the river Kebar, and he saw something out of the ordinary in the north. Now the north is customarily and symbolically the direction from which judgment came, at least to a Jew's mind. Most enemies did not attack from the east or the west. The reason they didn't come from the west is quite clear. They'd have to come through the Mediterranean. They'd have to come by sea. They didn't come from the east because Jerusalem or Israel was bordered on the east by the River Jordan, and to ford the Jordan would not be the easiest way to attack. Therefore, most nations, except Egypt, would attack from the north. They'd go up above the country and then come down from the north. Babylon did this, Assyria did this, and most nations that attacked them did this. So the north was historically or traditionally the direction specifying judgment. Well, he saw to the north a great cloud, a whirlwind. Now, a whirlwind sometimes is an image for an army coming and sweeping things away. We have this imagery used in Daniel chapter 11. We have it used later on in Ezekiel 38, about Gog and Magog comes in like a storm, like a whirlwind. And in this case, I don't think it's an exception. I think there's a sense in which we're to see an army coming, or so it would seem. Because it goes on, it just looked like a cloud at first. It just looked like a natural phenomenon, maybe a twister, maybe a tornado. But as he looked more carefully, he saw something within the cloud that he could just barely make out. There was sort of a sparkling color. Oh, here it's called amber, but amber is just the translator's guess. The word that's translated amber here is a very rare word in the Hebrew. It's found almost nowhere else in Hebrew literature. Therefore, no one knows quite what it means. But most new translations believe it has to do with a metallic kind of a color. The RSV, for instance, translates it bronze, and most new translators would agree with that. It was a metallic color that he could see flashing from inside this cloud or this whirlwind. Now, it was in the distance, so he couldn't quite make it out, but he could tell this was not an ordinary natural phenomenon because there was something metallic flashing in there. And as it got clearer, he begins to see what it is. And I'll tell you what it is before we read the description. What he saw was a vision of the chariot, the metallic chariot of God coming with his throne upon it. And this, of course, represented God coming to make war, coming to judge. And, of course, this is the character of his early prophecies. They're all about how God was coming to judge his people. Well, it goes in verse 5 to describe, verses 5 through 14, describe four grotesque beings that he first notices, or at least first describes, before he describes the chariot itself. These four beings apparently supported the chariot upon their wings. It says in verse 5, "And out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. And they four had the faces, had their faces and their wings. Their wings were joined one to another," or touching each other. "They turned not when they went, and they went every one straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man, and the face of a lion on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they four also had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces, and their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of every one were joined to one another, and two covered their bodies." Out of humility, apparently, or modesty. "And they went every one straight forward. Whither the Spirit was to go, they went. And they turned not when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps. It went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning." Now, it seems very clear that he's trying to describe something that's indescribable, because you do not really get a very satisfying picture from this description of what it was he saw. And even if you can somewhat picture it, you can't imagine what in the world it's talking about or what it means. One thing I'd like to call your attention to immediately is how frequently the term likeness is used. In verse 5, likeness and appearance are words that occur several times. What is, but it's a likeness of something. It's not as though when we go to heaven we're going to necessarily see these creatures with four faces and all, but it's rather this is a depiction. This is a pictorial representation, a likeness of some spiritual thing. And to support the idea that he didn't see things as they really are so much as a symbolic vision or likeness of certain principles, you might recall that in the book of Revelation, in chapter 4, when John was caught up into heaven, he also saw four living creatures. And they had some resemblance to these four. But there were some differences, too. In the case of the living creatures that John saw, they had the four faces, but not each of them having four, as is in this case. But in Revelation, each had one of the four. In Revelation, one of the living creatures had the face of a man, another the face of a lion, another the face of an ox, another the face of an eagle. Here, the creatures, each of them has all four faces. In this place, the living creatures have four wings. In Revelation, the living creatures have six wings. Interestingly, in Isaiah chapter 6, the seraphims that he saw there had six wings, and Revelation seems to follow the images from both the seraphims and these living creatures and put them together into one being. Now, what should we gather from all this? Should we assume that there are different kinds of creatures that have these faces in heaven? That, for instance, when we go to heaven and we can see everything in the Spirit, that we'll see these creatures that Ezekiel saw, plus we'll see other creatures like the ones that John saw, and others yet, like the ones that Isaiah saw with the six wings, the seraphim? Or is it possible, I believe it is, that what we see when we go to heaven will not be that exactly at all? Remember John, when he was caught up in the heaven and saw the four living creatures, he also saw Jesus. But what did Jesus look like? He looked like a lamb. Now that's a symbolic representation of Christ. Christ is not a literal lamb. He is the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world, but that is a symbolic picture of Christ. He is not a literal lamb, and when we see him, we will not see him as a lamb, but we will see him as he is, as Christ, with the holes in his hands and his feet, and we'll see him as he is. John saw symbolic visions of him, and Ezekiel, I believe, is seeing something that is of the same character, a symbolic portrayal of spiritual beings. And the fact that the images of a lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle appear in Ezekiel's vision and also in John's, yet the pictures they saw were not identical but have the same elements, leads me to the conclusion that these are symbolic of certain spiritual ideas or certain spiritual principles that in various visions have been gathered into different forms, but they recur anyway. That is to say, there is something symbolically valuable about there being a lion in each case, and an ox, and a man, and an eagle. But to say that there are creatures that we will see that look like this may or may not necessarily be the case. Now, I've never ascended into heaven myself. I can't tell you what's to be seen there and what is not to be seen there. And maybe we will see creatures just like this. But my understanding is he's talking about the likeness of something. He didn't see a thing itself, but a likeness, a symbolic picture. And that is just an assumption that I begin with, just for the reasons that I've just given you on this. We're told certain things about them here immediately. There were four of them, and it says in verse 5, they had the likeness of a man, although that hardly seems true, since we've never met men who had four faces and four wings and so forth. I guess we should say they had the overall appearance of a man in the sense that they stood upright, unlike animals. In saying their feet were straight feet in verse 7, probably legs is better to be understood. Their legs were straight, like a human's legs, rather than the shape of animal legs. So these had a general human appearance, but with some very divergent peculiarities. The four wings, I should say the four faces, have been conjectured about a great deal. Many of the early rabbis believe that the four faces represent four aspects of the created animal kingdom. It was said by the rabbis that the lion was the chiefest and mightiest of the wild animals, and that the ox was the mightiest of the domestic animals, that the eagle was the mightiest of the birds, and that man was the mightiest of all creatures. And therefore, the rabbis believed that these four faces represented the mightiest of each class of created beings, the wild animals, the domestic animals, the birds of the heavens, and man representing the greatest of all. That's just a rabbinic idea. It's not necessarily inspired, and therefore we can't necessarily say that's what's intended. But on this view, it was believed that these living creatures simply represent the creation or the created realm under God. And there are many Christian scholars who take a similar view about the four living creatures in the book of Revelation. Many commentators understand the four living creatures in Revelation to represent the created realm. I'm not sure I agree with them, but that seems to be a common interpretation. So that's a rabbinic idea. Some early Christian writers, church fathers, held the view that these four faces represent four aspects of Christ and were connected with the four Gospels. It's obvious as you read the four Gospels that each writer of the Gospels presents a different aspect of Christ. And it was said that Matthew's Gospel presents Jesus as the King, the Messiah, represented by the lion. That Mark's Gospel represents him as the servant of all, represented by the ox, which its main function is to serve man. Luke's Gospel, it was said, pictured Jesus as very human, or as the Son of Man, and therefore the face of man would represent that aspect of Jesus' character. And John's Gospel represents Jesus as deity, as the Son of God, which the soaring eagle, the transcendence of the eagle overall, would represent the transcendence of Christ. Now that's how some of the church fathers understood the meaning of these four faces. Whether right or wrong, we can't say, but what they said was that as you look at Jesus from different angles, you see a different aspect. Just like a diamond that's cut, you can see different aspects of the diamond by looking at it from a different angle. And so each gospel record looks at Jesus from a slightly different aspect. One portrays him as the king, one as a servant, one as man, and one as God. Son of man, son of God are different aspects. Jesus the king, Jesus the servant are different aspects. And so these creatures, if you look at them from different angles, you see a different aspect. You see a different face. And so some suggest that these four faces represent the four aspects of Christ. Another and similar theory would hold that they represent four aspects of God's nature himself. The lion, of course, representing his kingliness, his royalty. The ox, representing his strength and might, because the ox is a very strong animal. The man's face representing God's intelligence, because man is considered the most intelligent of the animals. And the eagle, representing God's transcendence, or loftiness, or heavenliness. Now, those are three totally different theories about the meaning of these, and I'm not able to tell you which is the right one. But maybe none of them are. Maybe these faces don't represent anything. Maybe God just made animals or creatures that look like this and has no meaning whatsoever. However, I do believe that they do stand for something. I do believe there's something symbolic about these. And whether they represent different aspects of God himself or aspects of Christ, or whether they represent the creation and the highest member of each order of creation, are various theories that have been advanced, and it'd be nice if I could tell you which one is the correct one. However, to understand that will not necessarily give us more light into the message of Ezekiel. They had four wings. With two of them they covered their bodies, and with two they stretched out and touched the wings of others. These four apparently stood in a square formation with two of their wings outstretched, touching the wings tips of the others, so that the shape of their wings created a square. And upon this square there sat a platform. And it was supported also by wheels. And there was one wheel by each of these four living creatures. For each creature there appears to have been a wheel. And the wheels and the living creatures supported this platform upon which there was a throne and someone sitting on the throne. And so Ezekiel describes the creatures first, then the wheels and the platform, and then the throne. And he spends these 10 verses, 5 through 14, describing the creatures. Now, among the other things he says about the creatures, there are many things for which I can make no significant or helpful comment. But it does say that they went wherever the Spirit wanted them to go. In verse 12, they went everyone straight forward. Now, straight forward doesn't mean that they always went the same direction. It means that they didn't have to turn in order to go another direction because they had faces looking every direction. So they could, whichever way they were going straight forward. If you considered, you know, one of their faces was facing forward to whichever way they went. And it was saying there was no need for them to turn or to pivot, but that they could simply move at right angles without turning and still facing the direction they were going because of the peculiar situation of having four faces, one looking each direction. And it says that they went like lightning at the end of verse 13, and verse 14, the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning, meaning that they could go suddenly and quickly. Now, since they were bearing upon them the throne of God, as we shall see, this would represent perhaps the fact that God is governing and can move about, although this would be a slightly different idea than his universal presence, his omnipresence. But he can move about at the speed of lightning to any position or any place that he needs to go where his attention is required. And there's no There's no slowness about him. There's nothing to hinder him getting immediately to the trouble spot, that he's always on the scene wherever his attention and his sovereignty is needed to be expressed. Now, in verses 15 through 25, we have the description of the chariot, first of all, with the wheels. Now, as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by living creatures with his four faces. Now, it sounds like there's only one wheel, but as we read on, it's clear there were four wheels. There was one by each of the living creatures. The appearance of the wheels and their work was likened to the color of a barrel, a stone, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Now, this could be understood variously, but apparently, from the way the description proceeds, a wheel in the middle of a wheel does not mean... let me illustrate what I don't think it means, okay? I don't think it means, here's a wheel, and then there's another wheel inside of it like this. I believe what it's talking about is a wheel that is bisected or whatever by another wheel at a 90-degree angle, so that... That's not a very good depiction of it, but maybe I could just show you that two wheels that have that are built into each other this way, so it's sort of a universal wheel. It can go any direction. It doesn't have to turn. Like the creatures don't have to turn. As the creatures are at once facing all four directions, so the wheel is facing all four directions. It doesn't have to turn like a caster would or like any other kind of wheel would. It's an impossible wheel to construct. It's a physical impossibility. But that's not important to the vision. The vision is not describing physical realities, it's describing spiritual truths. And the idea is that it's like if you could picture a rim of a wheel and another rim going across at a 90-degree angle so it could roll any direction equally well. That is what is meant by a wheel in the middle of a wheel or in the midst of a wheel. And when they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. And when it says they turned, it doesn't mean they didn't roll. It just means they didn't turn in the sense of changing directions. They rolled, of course. That's what wheels are for. But in saying they don't turn, it means the same thing as when the living creatures don't turn. They don't have to turn in order to roll any direction they choose, because they're sort of a universal wheel there, like a universal joint. As for their rings, which would be their rims, they were so high that they were dreadful. And their rims, or their rings, were full of eyes round about them four. Now that's a peculiar characteristic of a wheel, to have eyes all around the rims. Now what does a rim, or what does a wheel need with eyes on it? Obviously it doesn't need eyes at all. I believe that the presence of those eyes around the rims is again another symbolic thing. Eyes in the scripture represent obviously the ability to see, and by implication the ability to know. There's in Zechariah a depiction of a stone that had seven eyes on it. And these seven eyes are carried over in the book of Revelation chapter 5 on the Lamb. The Lamb has seven horns and seven eyes. Horns representing strengths, eyes representing knowledge. All seven horns would be all strength, all power. Seven eyes represent all knowledge. That is at least how I understand the picture of the Lamb with the seven horns and the seven eyes in Revelation. He has all power and all knowledge. Well, the eyes here also convey the idea of knowledge. The wheels are facing every direction, and they're full of eyes, so that in a sense they can see every direction. And if this is depicting something about God, as likely, it means that God can see all in every direction. Now, we might wish for more elaborate interpretation than that, but I'm not sure anything more elaborate is intended. If the eyes are facing every direction, the wheels are full of eyes, they can see all at all times. Verse 20 says, whithersoever the Spirit was to go, they went. Thither was their spirit to go, and the wheels were lifted up over against them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. What that means, what does it mean the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels? Probably it means the same Spirit of God that moved the living creatures was also moving the wheels, because it says the same thing about the wheels as about the living creatures. It says in verse 12 about the creatures, they went ever straight forward. Whither the Spirit was to go, they went. That is, they were instantly responsive to the will of God's Spirit. Whatever He wanted, they did. The same as to the wheels. That wherever the Spirit wanted them to go, they went. And therefore, saying the Spirit of the living creature was in the wheels, what it means is the same Spirit that moved the creatures was the Spirit that moved the wheels. Both the wheels and the living creatures were moved and instantly responsive to the will of the Spirit. When those went, these went. Probably meaning when the creatures went, the wheels went, and vice versa. And when those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up over against them. For the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. And the likeness of the firmament, now the word firmament here should be probably understood as a platform in this case. It's the platform that the wheels are supporting, the platform of the chariot, the chassis. The likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creature was as the color of terrible crystal, stretched forth over their heads above, and under the firmament, or under the platform, were their wings straight, the one toward the other. Every one had two, which covered his side, covered on this side, excuse me, and everyone had two which covered on that side their bodies. And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, and as the noise of an host. When they stood, they let down their wings. And there was a voice from the firmament that was over their hands when they stood and had let down their wings. Now that's very difficult, of course, to imagine what's being said, but apparently, to put it in the simplest terms, they stretched out two of their four wings, as I said earlier, to touch the tips of the wings of another living creature, and they stood in a square formation, one by each of the wheels. It was a four-wheeled vehicle that they saw with this platform on top, very peculiar in every detail. But the idea here is that God's chariot was attended by these creatures, and the wheels and the creatures were both equipped to go in any direction at lightning speed without turning. They could see everywhere, know everything. God's chariot, in other words, had access to every point in the world. God knew everything. He was able to be there and to attend to things as he desired. His rulership is universal over the earth. Now, I might add that the living creatures, which are not here identified for us, that is, they're not given a name here, they later appear in his second vision in chapters 8 through 10, and particularly, or 8 through 11, but particularly in chapter 10, they are described again exactly as they are in chapter 1. However, in chapter 10, we're given a different little piece of information about them. In Ezekiel 10:15, it says, "The cherubim that lifted up, this is the living creature that I saw by the river Kebar." Here we're told they were cherubim. We were not told that in chapter 1. This is the first indication we get of what creatures these were. These were cherubim. Now remember, the creatures that Isaiah saw in Isaiah chapter 6 were called seraphim. Cherubim and seraphim are plural words. I've told you before that the letters I-M at the end of a Hebrew word make it a plural, just like adding the letter S in English does to us. Now, where the King James translators say cherubims, what they're doing is compounding plural suffixes. You know, it's the Hebrew suffix plus the English suffix. That's just, I guess, because they don't know, you know, how to make this Hebrew idiosyncrasy clear to their readers, but they could have said cherubs and seraphs to make it understandable. These were cherubs. And what Isaiah saw were seraphs. And what we see in Revelation, the living creatures, they seem to be a combination of the cherubs and the seraphs, which gives us the reason to question whether these are literal beings or whether they are symbolic beings, that is, whether they really exist as beings that we will someday know and converse with and see, or whether these are just a trance-like vision that he had where God gave him a vision of creatures that maybe don't really even exist, but which represent realities. Just they may exist, but it's hard to say, you know, what their function is, except that cherub, we can say cherubs have an existence. Whether they really look like this, you know, when you're not seeing them in symbolic visions, I don't know. But cherubs, of course, have appearances elsewhere in the Scripture. As early as Genesis chapter 3, when God drove Adam and Eve out of the garden, he set cherubim with a flaming sword to guard the way to the tree of life, to keep them from it. And later, of course, there were carved cherubs of gold over the mercy seat on the Ark of the Covenant, two of them. And then there were a lot of cherubims embroidered on the tent, on the curtains and on the veils of the tabernacle. A lot of cherubim there, too. And so the cherubim are seen more than once in the Scripture. They always seem to have a guardian kind of a role. Guarding the tree of life, guarding the Ark of the Covenant, guarding the chariot of God here. almost here giving the effect of a personal bodyguard. Not that God needs a bodyguard, or even has a body, for that matter, but it's the idea of painting a picture of a royal and important personage who's coming on his chariot, and he's got his attendants about him, and his guardians, not in any way suggesting that he needs guardians, but that just to fill in the whole picture of a majestic king coming on his incredible chariot. Okay, and then it says in verses 26 through 28, it describes what was upon the chariot, a throne and one on a throne. And above the firmament, or above the platform that was over their heads, was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above it. Now notice how frequently he says likeness, likeness, likeness. He's not saying he saw a throne and saw a man. He saw what was like a throne, or like a man. Of course, he couldn't say it was a man, because God is not a man, and what he was seeing was God on his throne. And since no man can really see God and live, even Moses, who was a man of much greater stature than the man Ezekiel, Moses was not permitted to look upon God. Therefore, we should understand that Ezekiel didn't see God, but he saw a vision that was a likeness of God. And again, in this case, God appeared in the likeness of a man. And since God is not a man, but the vision he saw was a likeness of a man, again, we might assume that all these things they saw that were a likeness of something may not depict things as they really are, but depict them in such a way as to give a symbolic picture of some spiritual reality. It says in verse 27, "And I saw, as the color of amber, as the appearance of fire round about within it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loins even downward. I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire. It had the brightness round about." Now, why it describes him from his loins upward and his loins downward separately, when he says the same thing about both, he had the appearance of fire upwards and downwards from his loins, well, he could have simply said he looked entirely like fire. I don't know. It simply tends to be, it seems one of those cases of repetitiousness in the style of the writer, but at any rate, we see that the man he saw was sort of the likeness of a man. Notice how little detail he's given here, because he spends 10 verses or so describing the creatures and the same amount describing the wheels and the chariot, but only one verse describing the one on the throne. Why is this? Why so much detail describing the others and so little describing the one who represents God? It seems obvious that he wants to give no occasion to the Jews to try to make images. That they might make an image of a cherub or of a chariot would not be such a bad thing unless they worshipped him, but for them to try to make an image of God is strictly forbidden. Therefore, he doesn't give a description adequate to make an image from. So it would seem to be why he gives such an undetailed description of God on the throne. It says in verse 20, "As the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about." There was a brightness around the throne that was like a rainbow. Also, you might recall in Revelation 4, when John was caught into heaven, he saw the rainbow over the throne of God. So both images, of course, Revelation borrows heavily from Ezekiel and many of its images, but both revelations of God's throne, Ezekiel's and John's, see a rainbow surrounding or overarching his throne. The idea being, of course, the rainbow is a symbol of God's grace. Why God's grace? Because God sent a flood on the earth in the days of Noah because man's imaginations and the thoughts of their hearts were always evil continually. So he sent the flood. After the flood, he determined that he would never again flood the earth, although, he said, man's thoughts and imaginations of his heart are still always evil continually. And he put the rainbow in the clouds so that when he, that is God, would see it, he would remember his covenant not to destroy them anymore. But the interesting thing is, he acknowledges that the same sins exist in man after the flood as before the flood. The same conditions that caused him to send the flood still exist in man's heart after the flood, and yet, despite the fact that man has not improved, God makes a promise that he won't send that judgment again. In other words, it's strictly a matter of grace. If he saw that man was improved, that man was better now, and he said, okay, now I'm not going to send a flood because things are better now, then that wouldn't be grace. That would simply be, you know, keeping with his justice. That when things are bad, he judges, and when things are good, he doesn't. But at the end of the flood, in chapter 9 of Genesis, God acknowledges, or chapter 8, he acknowledges that man is just as bad as before, but in spite of that fact, he's going to show mercy. He's not going to judge as before. So the rainbow, I see, is a picture of grace, any other opinions about the meaning of the rainbow would be hard to establish from any place in Scripture. It says also, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So if anyone wonders what it was, you know, some people who are unlearned and unstable, restless, as they do the other Scriptures, to their own destruction, and they say, well, this is a UFO or something like that. I don't know if you've ever read that, but Von Daniken and others have thought, well, see, Ezekiel saw one of the UFOs, and he described it in this way, and he mistook it for God and so forth.
The eyes
around it and the flashing light, yeah. Right, there's a lot of things in the description. There's a lot of things in the description that if you want to use your imagination, you can apply them to a UFO, especially since no one knows what a UFO is supposed to look like. You can make it look like the description here, you know? I mean, if you want to. But obviously, he tells us what it is he saw. He says, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So it wasn't a UFO. It was the glory of the Lord, only it was a likeness or the appearance of the likeness of. I mean, he gets about as far removed from saying he saw the glory of the Lord as he can. It was the likeness of the appearance of the glory of the Lord. At any rate, that's what it represented. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake. Now we have a very short chapter, chapter 2. And he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. And the Spirit entered into me when he spake unto me, and set me upon my feet, that I heard him that spake unto me. And he said unto me, Son of man, I send thee to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that hath rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me, even unto this very day. For they are impudent children and stiff-hearted. I do send thee unto them, and thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God. And then whether they will hear, or whether they will forbear, for they are a rebellious house, yet shall know that there hath been a prophet among them. And thou, son of man, be not afraid of them, neither be afraid of their words. Though briars and thorns be with thee, and thou dost dwell among scorpions, be not afraid of their words, nor be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. And thou shalt speak my words unto them, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are most rebellious. But thou, son of man, hear what I say unto thee. Be not thou rebellious like that rebellious house. Open thy mouth and eat that which I give thee. And when I looked, behold, an hand was sent unto me, and lo, a roll of a book, that is a scroll, was therein. And he spread it before me, and it was written within and without. And there was writing, there was written therein lamentations and mourning and woe. Now, this is his call to be a prophet. Some of the recurring thoughts that come up very repeatedly in this short chapter are the word rebellious. God obviously stresses how rebellious the Jews are. He says that the Spirit entered into him, which of course enabled him to be a prophet, because I remember that Moses, when he complained that he had too much of a burden, God said, we'll bring 70 elders to the tent door. And when he brought them to the tent door, God took of the Spirit that was on Moses and put on the 70, and they prophesied. Later on, when it was found that two of them, Eldad and Medad, were not in the presence of the tabernacle prophesying, and Joshua complained about that and said, forbid them, Moses, to do that. Moses said, are you jealous for me? Would to God that all the Lord's people were prophets and that he would put his Spirit upon them. So for the Spirit to come upon a person was to make them a prophet. Now, not in every case, but Saul, for instance, was anointed to be king, and the Spirit came upon him, but he also prophesied. And David also, when the Spirit was taken from Saul and put on David, David also, we know, had a prophetic ministry as well as being a king. So the Spirit came upon him, which equipped him for the prophetic ministry, and he was told that he was sent to a stiff-hearted people. He was told that they were rebellious, and therefore he should not expect them to respond. Now, twice he says, and if they shall hear, whether they will hear, in verse 5, or whether they will forbear, yet they shall know that there has been a prophet among them. It almost sounds like God's not sure whether they'll hear the words or not, but God does know, and he tells them that they won't hear. So why does he say whether they will hear or whether they won't? Apparently because there would be some who would hear. There would be a few, perhaps, who would listen, but by and large, people would reject his message. Traditionally, Ezekiel was killed by his fellow exiles. That's not recorded in Scripture, but that's a Jewish tradition that he was eventually killed by his fellow exiles. They did not receive his message, but some would. But God says whether a person is of the group that believes your message or of the group that doesn't believe your message, yet all of them without exception will know that a prophet has been among them. And he says that also in verse 7. Well, he says whether they will hear or whether they will forbear. Now, he tells him to eat that which he gives him to eat. And he hands him a little scroll written inside and out. And what was written upon it was lamentation and mourning and woe. Scrolls often appeared in the visions of the prophets. Zechariah saw a flying scroll that had judgments and curses upon it, upon the wicked. John, in the book of Revelation, saw two scrolls of significance. One was first seen in chapter 4, which had seven seals upon it. And Revelation chapters 4 through 9 is largely about the breaking of those seven seals. But then in chapter 10 of Revelation, there's another little book, or another little scroll he sees, and the angel tells John to eat that little book. It's at the end of Revelation 10. The angel tells him to eat this little book, and when you eat it, it says, the angel said, it will be sweet in your mouth and bitter in your belly. And then when he ate it, John says, it was sweet in his mouth and bitter in his belly, and the voice said to him, you must prophesy again to many nations and peoples and tongues. Now, John, when he ate this book, it was sweet in his mouth and bitter in his belly, and he was therefore, thereafter said he would prophesy again. Well, Ezekiel also here, of course, had to eat this book, and no doubt this is for the origin of that image found in Revelation. A little book was given to him, written within and without. It was full of bad news, and he was supposed to eat it. Why? Did Ezekiel eat this book literally? Well, we don't know. If this all happened in a dream or a trance or a vision, it could be that this all happened in sort of a non-physical sense. He may not have physically eaten the scroll. On the other hand, we aren't told. Maybe he did. Ezekiel, among other things, had a very strange diet. You'll find in chapter 4, there was a special kind of bread he was supposed to make to eat for 390 days that was very unusual. He must have had a strong digestive system if he ate all the things literally that were supposed to be eaten, including this book. But it's very possible that all this happened in a vision, that he was not physically eating it, but he saw himself and he saw the Lord and he saw this book and everything. It all happened almost as we would have it in a dream, but he was awake and he was seeing a vision. And so he eats the book, and we have the record of what happened then in chapter 3. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, eat that thou findest, eat this roll, and go speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. This means that the words of God had to become part of him. He had to take them into himself. He couldn't just read them off of a paper elsewhere, but they had to become part of his own life, part of his own being, so that he would live the word, that they would come from his soul and from his heart, though they were God's words. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. And he said unto me, Son of man, cause thy belly to eat, and fill thy bowels with this roll that I give thee. Then did I eat it, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness. Now, remember John in Revelation 10, verses 9 and 10, said that he ate the scroll. It was sweet in his mouth and bitter in his belly. Here it does not mention it being bitter in his belly. However, later on, in verse 14, it says, So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness, in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me. So actually, there was a bitterness that resulted from him receiving this word. Sometimes, just the privilege of having God's words revealed to you, of getting insights even in the Scripture, of having the Holy Spirit speak to you and give you insights into God's word, it's sort of a sweet thing. It's Jeremiah said, Thy words were found, and I did eat them, and thy word was unto me the joy and rejoicing of my heart. David said that concerning the words of God, sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb are they. So there's a sense in which coming to know the will of God, receiving His word, is a sweet experience. It's a pleasant experience. It's exhilarating. However, when the word is a bad word, and when it's bad news, there's a sense of bitterness. There's a burden that comes with it. After you've had a time to reflect or digest or sense what the real import of the message is, it can bring a heaviness about it, as was the case here. Now it says in verse 4, And he said unto me, Son of man, go, get thee unto the house of Israel, and speak with my words unto them, for thou art not sent to a people of strange speech and of a hard language, but to the house of Israel, not to many people of a strange speech and of a hard language, whose words thou canst not understand. Surely had I sent thee to them, they would have hearkened to thee. But the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent, and hard-hearted. Now, it's interesting that he says, I'm sending you to people who know your language and you can speak easily to them. I'm not sending you to foreign people whose language you don't know. But he interjects, if I did, they would listen. But your people won't. Again, one of the many places in the Old Testament that show that the Gentiles frequently are more receptive to God's word than the Jews, God's own people, were. The book of Jonah is a good example of that, too. And there are many others, examples of that in the scriptures. This is one of them. God says, if I sent you to foreign people who spoke foreign language and who are not your people, they'd be receptive. But your people are rebellious and stiff-necked and hard-hearted and impudent, and they won't hear. Verse 8, behold, I have made thy face strong against their faces, and thy forehead strong against their foreheads. As an adamant harder than flint have I made thy forehead. This just means that you're going to be strong-willed and bull-headed, and they're not going to be able to intimidate you. Fear them not, neither be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, all my words that I shall speak unto thee, receive in thine heart, eating them, taking them into his body, was symbolic of taking them into his heart and letting his heart receive and agree with the words so that they become, as I said, his words even. And hear with thine ears, and go, get thee to them of the captivity, unto the children of thy people, and speak unto them, and tell them, thus saith the Lord God, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear. Then the Spirit took me up, and I heard behind me a voice of a great rushing, saying, blessed be the glory of the Lord from his place. I heard also the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and the noise of a great rushing. So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness and in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me. Then I came to them of the captivity of Tel Abib, that dwelt by the river of Kebar, and I sat where they sat, and remained there astonished among them 7 days. He was silent for 7 days, just as Job was with his friends, when his seven friends sat with him for 7 days. He just was so moved by the visions and by the words that he had received that he was practically stunned. He was in shock. He was astonished. He couldn't speak for 7 days. And it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die. Because thou hast not given him warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteousness, which he hath done, shall not be remembered. But his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live. Because he is warned, also thou hast delivered thy soul. Well, it seems like a long way of saying it, but basically he's saying you're like a watchman who watches for the enemy. And when danger approaches, you're supposed to alert the people. And just as a watchman, if he sees the enemy coming but doesn't alert the people, is personally responsible for the overthrow of his city. So in the moral realm, where he sees the danger and God's judgment coming, if he doesn't warn the people and give them a chance to repent, then he's responsible for their blood. Now, if he does warn them and they don't listen, they'll die anyway, but he won't be held responsible. So the idea is that he has a responsibility and an obligation to discharge, and he'd better not neglect it, or else consequences will come upon him for blood guiltiness. And the call of God upon you to warn people is not something that can be taken lightly, because God doesn't call everybody quite in the same way and doesn't give everybody the revelation. So when you have a revelation, you're made more responsible, and you've got to tell people what you know. And of course, we have the gospel and knowledge of salvation, have that kind of an obligation also to the rest of the world, as the Great Commission indicates. And the hand of the Lord was there upon me, and he said unto me, arise, go forth into the plain, and I will there talk with thee. Then I arose and went forth into the plain. Behold, the glory of the Lord stood there, as the glory which I saw by the river Kebar, and I fell on my face. Then the Spirit entered into me, and set me upon my feet, and spake with me, and said unto me, go shut thyself within thine house. But thou, O son of man, behold, they shall put bands upon thee, and shall bind thee with them, and thou shalt not go out among them. And I will make thy tongue cleave to the roof of thy mouth, that thou shalt be dumb, and thou shalt not be to them a reprover, for they are a rebellious house. And when I speak with thee, I will open thy mouth, and thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith the Lord, He that heareth, let him hear, and he that forbeareth, let him forbear, for they are a rebellious house. Well, the same thing could have been said much shorter, perhaps, but what he's saying is that the Lord at this point told Joshua, shut himself in his house. Apparently he was instructed to have someone put chains on him to represent captivity. Of course, his prophecy was that they would remain in captivity and that the rest of the Jews who had not yet been taken would yet go into captivity. And there would be this sign similar to that which was given to Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, that he was struck dumb until the birth of John the Baptist. But in this case, Ezekiel was struck dumb until the death of his wife, which was a six-year period from this time. For a six-year period, he was dumb, with the exception that when God had a word for him to speak, God would supernaturally give him the ability to speak. Now, this is a pretty good safeguard that most prophets did not have, nor do they still. And it would be kind of nice if they did sometimes, because he says, I'm going to make you dumb so that you shall not be a reprover to them. That is to say, you're not going to vent your bitterness upon the people, as some prophets tend to do. Sometimes the prophets go beyond what God tells them to say and begin to include their own venom to the message. But Ezekiel was a man who would not have that opportunity. God was making him dumb so that he could not speak except when he had a word from the Lord. And this condition prevailed until the death of his wife in chapter, I think, 24, and then apparently he regained normal powers of speech. Well, this is just a description of his call to the ministry and his actual prophecies. We haven't actually read any of the prophecies yet. He has not yet begun to speak to the people. We only hear what God has said to him in preparation for his ministry, and in chapter 4 we begin to see his first public actions and message. And we'll wait, of course, till next time for that.